Welcome to the History Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Thomason. The History Podcast is an educational podcast intended to engage student and lifelong learning in American history. Without further delay, let's get to it. Welcome to the podcast. American religion is a topic that we have already discussed in a previous podcast. And before we get started, if you haven't listened to episode 40 about religions in the colonies, I would strongly encourage you to press pause here, go back and listen to episode 40 before you give this a listen. While historically, there are two great awakenings, today's episode is going to be focused primarily on the First Great Awakening, which took place in the 1730s and 1740s. I do want to note that in 1790, we do see the second wave, and it does play a role in what we're going to talk about today. But for the most part, what we're going to be focusing on in today's episode is the first wave of the Great Awakening, a movement that will shake up American religion in ways that will change the course of American history. When we look at the First Great Awakening and even the Second Great Awakening, it's important to answer the question of why it took place. What caused this movement to occur? And as I mentioned just in the introduction, we talked about this in episode 40, but here's a brief recap. The colonies were not as religious as we sometimes nostalgically remember them being. And ministers from various denominations viewed their members as too worldly, too caught up in the desires of the flesh, and too busy for religion. In New England, the Congregationalists and the Episcopalians, especially, were established denominations with established members who were highly educated with affluent lifestyles. These establishment denominations, they believed that intellectually, when we look at the First Great Awakening, and quite frankly, even the Second Great Awakening, it's important to answer the question of why it took place. What caused this movement to occur? And while we talked about this in episode 40, as I mentioned in the introduction, here is a real quick recap. The colonies were not as religious as we nostalgically remember them being. And members from various denominations viewed their members as too worldly, too caught up in the desires of the flesh, and too busy for religion. In New England, the Congregationalists and the Episcopalians were the established denominations who had very established members, who were also very highly educated with affluent lifestyles. They had a very particular membership. The established denominations intellectually understood theology, and their clergy were highly trained theologians who went to seminary school. In the South, the Episcopalians, or as we sometimes call them, the Anglicans, were the same way. Highly established, highly educated members, highly trained clergy, and much more of an intellectual approach to faith. These established religions used theology to convince potential converts to the faith, hoping to rationally and logically convince them of their religious doctrine. In our modern world, sometimes we might even call these apologetics. However, the Great Awakening was more about convicting one's heart, not necessarily convincing someone intellectually. In other words, focusing on the heart and not the head. The clergy of this movement looked, dressed, and spoke much differently than the clergy of the established denominations. They often were not trained in theology. They wore clothes that better suited their audience and used language that was intended to drive one's emotions towards conversion. One of these men was Jonathan Edwards, a minister from Northampton, Massachusetts, who led revivals throughout different colonial towns, but arguably the most famous sermon he ever gave was his 1741 sermon entitled Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Edwards, like the clergy of this movement, was what we call an itinerant preacher, meaning he would travel from town to town to hold revivals where he would speak of the impending wrath of God and the need for sinners to come into a full relationship with him. Here is an excerpt from the aforementioned sermon. O sinner, consider the fearful danger you are in. It is a great furnace of wrath, a wide and bottomless pit full of the fire of wrath, that you are held over in the hand of that God whose wrath is provoked and incensed as much against you as against many of the damned in hell. You hang by a slender thread with the flames of the divine wrath flashing about it, and ready every moment to singe it and burn it asunder. And you have no interest in any mediator and nothing to lay hold of it to save yourself, nothing to keep off the flames of wrath, nothing of your own, nothing that you ever have done, nothing you can do to induce God to spare you one moment. He would later publish an account of this revival, titled A Faithful Narrative of the Surprising Work of God. This narrative of Edwards circulated throughout the colonies and even across the Atlantic. Once this publication got into the hands of George Whitefield and John Wesley, along with other evangelical ministers, it was their belief that they were in the middle of what we now historically call the Great Awakening. After receiving a degree from Oxford University, George Whitefield began his life as a traveling preacher, appealing to the emotions, or as we mentioned earlier, the heart, of his listeners at home in England. And now, at the age of 25, he was bound and determined to accomplish the same thing in the American colonies. It wouldn't take long for audiences to be captivated by his ability to communicate a message with a voice that carried across open fields, which would be very important, as you will find out throughout this podcast. Whitefield drew huge crowds. In the tens of thousands, people would put down their tools that they were in the middle of working with and travel miles just to see Whitefield speak. Many people in the audience would experience spiritual emotions that would bring them to their knees, some laying flat on their faces and others shouting and speaking in tongues. The message wasn't complex, and it wouldn't be sufficient in a theological seminary. But it was a simple message fit for his simple audience. It was this. Whitefield believed it wasn't enough for you to just be baptized or to go to church, that you must be converted by the Holy Spirit of God through a deep and personal examination of his or her own sinfulness. And he would call on these large crowds to be born again, and many were converted because of his preaching. While Jonathan Edwards had laid the foundation for revival in the British American colonies a few years earlier, Whitfield will be remembered more for his oratory skills and his passionate sermons. During his time in the colonies, it is believed that Whitfield reached 75 to 80% of the population. And while he drew large crowds and preached out in the open, local ministers and churches did not always take kindly to the itinerant preacher. They worried that these traveling preachers were undermining their authority and would steal members from their flock. One advantage that traveling preachers like Whitfield, Edwards, and John Wesley had was that they would preach a sermon and then move on to the next town only to give the same exact sermon. And as a fellow teacher, you might appreciate this. And students, I hate to give this inside secret, but the afternoon courses usually get our best lessons because we've taught it 5 to 6, sometimes even 7 times by the time we get to you. And there's an advantage to that. That naturally leads us to the disadvantages that the local churches, the local ministers in these local churches had. They saw the same body every week, and they were expected to deliver something new to this body of believers. Whereas the itinerant preacher learned how to perfect this particular sermon before he moved on. The tensions were increased when a certain itinerant minister by the name of Gilbert Tennant from New Jersey suggested that some local preachers were Christian only in name because they had not yet experienced the new birth going on in true believers. And he encouraged these true believers to leave the lukewarm established congregations and join the new quote-unquote pure churches. So why were they able to draw such huge crowds? Maybe a better way of approaching this is to address who the revivalists were. These itinerant preachers attracted audiences who were uneducated, who were often destitute and poor, leaving them outside of the affluent establishment of their society. They also attracted Native Americans and African Americans, even ordaining them as ministers in some cases, but usually only allowed to preach in their own communities. There were a lot of critics of the quote-unquote New Light ministers that were a part of this Great Awakening, believing that the movement brought about, as they, and I'm quoting this, foolishness and social chaos. It's important to note here that there was another movement going on at this time, which is what we call the Enlightenment movement. This was a movement that focused more on rationalism and reason, as opposed to convicting one's heart, like the Great Awakening movement. Enlightenment thinkers thought that there was no need for the Bible, that they could look at nature and understand that there was likely a higher power out there, but they weren't believers in what the Bible necessarily taught. They're what we call deists. Some of the more notable Enlightenment thinkers of this period are guys like Thomas Paine, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson. Still, The greatest opposition that the preachers of the Great Awakening faced came from the local preachers, or as we historically called them, the quote-unquote old light ministers, who insisted on methodical, rational, and intellectual sermons, who insisted on strict religious disciplines free from passionate outbursts. Lyman Beecher, a Congressionalist minister whose contempt for Methodists and Baptists was quite apparent within the community, said in an 1814 address in front of a charitable group, go figure, that funded seminary scholarships for students at Lane Theological Seminary, where he was the president, that the itinerant preacher in the Methodist and Baptist denominations were, and I quote, ignorant and unlettered men, adding that such men are, and I quote, utterly unacquainted with theology, that illiterate men have never been the chosen instruments of God to build up his cause. He might want to check the Bible again. It seems that he realized later in this speech before this charitable group that what he said was not correct, and tried to recover by stating that the 12 disciples were tutored by Jesus for 3 years to supply the deficiency of an education. In any event, Beecher felt entirely justified to call an area destitute, as long as it was without educated mainline clergy who understood theology forwards and backwards. It didn't matter to him how many Methodist and Baptist churches were in the area. In fact, he regarded those two denominations and the churches that might exist in those communities, and I quote, as worse than nothing. That if those communities had Methodist and Baptist churches in them, they would be better off having nothing there than to have a Methodist or Baptist church in that community. This would not stop the movement from thriving, though. Large open fields would be used with tents set up and pews made out of logs for their audience to sit and to listen. But when we get to the latter part of the 1740s, the New England revivals begin to slow down considerably. But the movement will continue to spread into the middle and southern colonies. The established church began to lose its hold on colonial America, giving rise to the Baptists and Methodists, who will see their membership really take off because of the first and second wave of the Great Awakening. The Methodists may have seen the greatest long-term benefits from the New Light movement, as they will see tremendous membership growth over the next 70-plus years. When you compare the Methodist adherence rate, which we talked about in episode 40, the Methodist adherence rate in the colonies by 1776, you may remember if you listen to that, we never even mentioned the Methodists during that episode because they were so small. Their adherence rate in 1776 was 2.5%. But by the time we get to 1850, it was at 34.2%. In 1776, the Methodists were a tiny religious society with 65 churches scattered all throughout the colonies. But by 1850, there were 13,302 Methodist congregations with more than 2.6 million members, making it the largest denomination in the country, accounting for more than a third of all American church members. No denomination during this window even comes close. The Catholics had 1.8% adherence in 1776, and by 1850 were up to 13.9%. The Baptists saw an increase of 4% during the same window, moving from 16% to 20%, but neither one of those come close to the growth that we see by the Methodists. Conversely, the three established denominations will see a major decrease over this period, And as we mentioned in the previous episode, in 1776, the Congregationalists, the Episcopalians, and the Presbyterians, with the exception of the Baptists, because we talked about that, had the largest adherence rates. But by 1850, the Congregationalists and the Episcopalians had plummeted. I mean, plummeted. They had plummeted down to 4% and 3.5% respectively. The Presbyterians had seen a dip as well, but not to that extent, largely because they were willing to go into some of the new American frontiers in the West, like the Methodists and Baptists. But the Presbyterians failed to see the growth match their expansion of the proportion of those who were churched. As we move into the middle part of the 19th century, many of the establishment attributes that the upstart sects like the Methodist and the Baptist criticized and, quite frankly, went out of their way to avoid, slowly began to creep into their own denominations. For example, the Methodist and the Baptist, especially the Northern Baptist, will require theological seminary training at their own theological seminary colleges. One of the more abhorrent practices used by the established congregations like the Congregationalists and the Episcopalians was the renting of church pews. You would pay to have your seat reserved within the church. And the more ideal seat was more expensive. And by the 1820s, we will see the Catholics utilize this practice. And by the middle part of the 19th century, we will even see the Methodists institute this same policy in order to generate revenue, becoming more and more established themselves. Now, regardless of how you feel about the Great Awakening, I think it's very important that we see this as a warning. If the colonists will challenge the religious establishment in New England, why wouldn't they challenge the political establishment in England? That, however, is a topic for another day. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to the History Podcast. We would like your feedback, good or bad, so that we can better serve our audience. If you have a question you would like for us to answer in a future podcast or have a topic request, leave that as well. If you haven't already subscribed to the History Podcast, go ahead and do that now so that you'll get notified when new episodes come out. You can find the History Podcast on any of your podcast streaming platforms. The History Podcast is an Anchor FM production.